Hello and welcome to Power Problems. I'm John Glazer. My guest today is David Sturman, a senior policy analyst at New America's Future Security Program. David, welcome back on the show.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to be exploring what's called U.S. counterterrorism policy, but specifically here about the ongoing use of the tactic of targeted drone strikes, which David keeps incredibly meticulous track of, in a number of countries with the broad justification of counterterrorism. And we'll be exploring some crucial work by David on the problems with this approach. David, I'd love it if you could start us out with giving listeners some sense of the scope of the use of drone strikes in counterterrorism policy. You know, the basic story is that Bush used what was then a kind of new technology relatively sparingly after 9/11. Obama ramped it up considerably, particularly in Pakistan, but elsewhere as well. And then there's, you know, any insights you can give us on the trend since then as well in Trump and now Biden's term. Give us a broad overview of how presidents have used this tactic.
Definitely. So the use of drones and also other kinds of airstrikes was really, at the very beginning of the war on terror, pretty restricted to the sort of actual core battlefields of Afghanistan, and then a little bit later, Iraq, once the U.S. invades. And of course, there's a distinction between what ends up being tied into the counterterrorism aspect and what was just the sort of invasion of Iraq against the actual state in that early period. But what began to grow initially under the Bush administration, but really increasing under the Obama administration, was the use of these tactics of airstrikes and drone strikes outside of those widely recognized battlefields. So there were, under the Bush administration, there was one strike in Yemen in 2002. And that strike actually drew a lot of backlash, both from sort of the international community, viewing it as an extrajudicial killing, and then also from the Yemeni government, which had cooperated with the strike, but was angry that the U.S. had claimed responsibility for it when they had sort of perceived an agreement for it to be kept secret and the U.S. not to claim responsibility for conducting strikes on its territory. And after that backlash, as far as our tracking and others show, the U.S. really held off from such strikes in Yemen. However, around 2004, the U.S. begins to start a larger campaign of these strikes in Pakistan, in the tribal areas. And that begins to grow under the Bush administration, particularly increasing towards the end of the Bush administration, as the U.S. and Western countries more generally begin to perceive, and for real reasons, an Al-Qaeda reconstitution and threat coming out of the Pakistan. And that campaign continues to escalate in the Obama administration. At the same time, you have the drone campaign in Pakistan is getting linked into this war in Afghanistan. And you see the number of strikes increasing in sort of a similar and then decreasing in a way that somewhat correlates or mirrors the increase and decrease of U.S. troops in Afghanistan. Or basically, we could probably understand that as a U.S. overall commitment to military force in Afghanistan. By the end of the Obama administration, drones in Pakistan are pretty much paused. Trump continues that pause for a little bit, increases them a bit, and then stops them towards the later part, mid part of his administration. And then there's sort of the negotiation process and policies leading up to the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, combined with just the decimation of al-Qaeda's senior leadership during the drone campaign, as well as increased Pakistani military activity. And some combination of that seems to have eliminated the U.S. drone campaign in Pakistan, which, according to our tracking, has not seen a strike since 2018. However, in Yemen, strikes really spiked up in the first year of the Trump administration, continuing an escalation from the late Obama administration. And that seems tied into a sort of growth in al-Qaeda's strength in Yemen, following the sort of breakout of the latest bout of the civil war and al-Qaeda's ability to take or operate territorially in Yemen. You see similar spike under Trump in Somalia, although there's also an increasing escalation across the Obama administration. But what's interesting is that in Yemen, those strikes begin to fall pretty quickly under the Trump administration, which leads us to today, where surprisingly, even as the Middle East more broadly seems to be in a massive regional conflagration, we're actually at a low point, probably an unprecedented low point, for U.S. counterterrorism operations using this sort of drone strikes or other forms of strikes outside of recognized battlefields, with the possible exception of Somalia.
Yeah, and we'll get to Somalia some more in a bit. And later on in the conversation, we'll also talk about this, what seems to have been from the beginning of the war on terror, a very amorphous bounds and limits on where the conflict is, who's an allowable target, what the objectives are, and so on. And you've done a lot of good work on that. What would you say about the scope of civilian casualties that these kinds of strikes have produced over the years? I imagine it's changed over time and it's irregular and different watchdogs have different counts and so on. But what can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it's the first thing to say is that it's hard to know because everyone is sort of based on reporting, especially in the early period, but also this is an issue again. Some of these strikes are covert. There's increasingly questions of whose strike is it actually? So who gets the responsibility and blame for civilian casualties? Our data suggests that early on in the drone program and these conflicts, U.S. strikes were causing some, not as large as some trackers and organizations put it, but certainly were causing not insignificant numbers of civilian casualties, but that it really began to fall as the regulations began to be imposed upon when drone strikes could be used. And the technology of the drone, specifically of the drone, at least allows a higher level of precision if you're using it with that goal in mind. The ability to have longer term surveillance, clear monitoring of who you're striking. Now, if that's not what's being maximized for in the policy objectives or the, I guess, tactical guidance for when you get to conduct a strike, that's not going to save the issue. But it is something that distinguishes it, or likely distinguishes it from other forms of weapons the U.S. has and can use. Now, under the Trump administration, particularly in, I'd say, Yemen, I think we just sort of, trackers lost the ability to really be able to tell what's actually happening with the strikes. And in particular in Yemen, CENTCOM was not reporting really death tolls meaningfully with its press releases for strikes, on top of which there was probably some level of a covert campaign as well, which isn't even getting press releases. So particularly in that 2017 spike in Yemen, I think we just don't have a good sense. And in Somalia, there is reason to believe that civilian casualties may have increased under the Trump strikes as rules were loosened and the U.S. committed to a greater military effort there and more offensive campaigns. But that seems to have, as the Biden administration restricted the strikes, that seems to have been reduced. And according to the U.S. assessments of this past year, they don't assess any civilian casualties in 2023 from their strikes. Although another issue here is that U.S. strikes in Somalia are backing partner forces. And whether or not the U.S. calculation is correct about recent assessments of the amount of civilian casualties, we know there are civilian casualties from some of those partner operations. And indeed, one of the question cases involves the strike in September that, or alleged strike in September that the U.S. says it did not conduct, but the U.S. came in and has acknowledged evacuating civilians out of the for health medical care as a result of the broader operation. And that operation, I believe the U.S. has acknowledged and provided account of civilians who were killed in that operation, although it does not, it says it was not a United States strike or operation generally.
Just broadly, you've mentioned this in some of your work, and I've read some other analysts mentioning it. Biden does not appear to have changed, because you mentioned, you know, we might have reached a low point in the intensity of these strikes, you know, since the war on terror started. But Biden has not fundamentally changed the use of these strikes and counterterrorism policy. But one thing he is doing rather differently than his predecessors is trying to stay extra quiet about it. But you argue that that really won't do, and that a very publicly announced shift in policy is actually what we need, rather than just trying to keep the status quo out of the headlines, so to speak. Can you talk about this kind of dodgy, hush-hush approach from Biden?
Yeah, I think it's a little complicated because there do appear to be some real changes in what the U.S. is doing, although they're not all things that happened under just in a sudden shift under Biden. What I'm talking about more there is that there's these overarching authorities for what the U.S. can do. And the Biden administration is actually, in some ways, it has been pretty explicit about saying that it's ended the war or America's wars, particularly in the wake of the withdrawal from Afghanistan. Notably, at a UN speech, I believe a few months or a month after the withdrawal, Biden stated that for the first time in decades, the U.S. was not at war in the greater Middle East. So in that way, it's not quiet. On the other end, right around that time, the U.S. also conducted strikes in Syria, and there were strikes in Somalia, so it's not, that claim is not entirely accurate. But at the same time, these larger sort of authorities, most notably the 2001 authorization for the use of military force that has largely been the foundation for the claim of authority to conduct counterterrorism operations, remains in place. And despite some effort at negotiations at reforms, they just haven't really moved forward in a way that has actually gotten to changing anything. So the authority remains in place. Operations at some level remain in place. And the other part is the Biden administration has mostly shied away from the rhetoric of defeating or destroying Al-Qaeda or other terrorist groups, which in my view is a positive thing, since my analysis is it is not really possible to achieve that objective. But on the other hand, it hasn't really presented that in sort of a public discussion of what is our objective now, if that objective has been abandoned as unachievable, what are the objectives tied to whatever continuation of U.S. force? And relatedly, even though there's sort of a top level abandonment of that frame of defeat, you still see that language. For example, in the Counter ISIS campaign is built around the concept of defeating ISIS. You see it a little bit every now and then in the way that U.S. operations in Somalia are framed, although the argument there is the Somali government and our partners there would be the ones defeating al-Shabaab, not us. But that's sort of what I mean, that there is this backing away and quietness on some of the larger claims, certainly from the sort of early Bush era height of war on terror rhetoric, but also even from the way the Obama administration discussed a desire to destroy or defeat al-Qaeda. But it's not necessarily reflected in an end to operations or a clear statement of what the replacing objective is.
I want to ask you about Biden's approach to Somalia, which you've mentioned a couple times. A couple years ago, Biden empowered the Pentagon with standing authority to target al-Shabaab. Can you just start out by telling us about al-Shabaab? Why is the U.S. targeting them, and what are they up to?
Yeah, so I'm not an expert in Somalia and the politics of Somalia and al-Shabaab and its rise. So, with that noted, I think the overarching aspects going into U.S. involvement in Somalia is that al-Shabaab is an al-Qaeda affiliate. Its leadership did formally affiliate itself with al-Qaeda in, I believe, 2012. And before that, there was sort of an informal agreement to basically be connected and communication back to bin Laden, but also a desire to keep the public level and formality more hush to avoid U.S. escalation and greater U.S. involvement. So in part, you just have the U.S. does not want to see an al-Qaeda affiliate hold or take significant territory. That's combined with the U.S. does not want to see the Somali government collapse. And I think also now there was real fear of that. And now there's hope that maybe the government can be empowered and really claim some victories. There's more an optimism in the past year or two, I think. And then there is a little bit of concern, and it's not, I don't think it's shared by everyone, certainly, in the government, but there's a little bit of concern about a growing al-Shabaab threat that's not local. And the primary form that takes is its sort of regional activity in Kenya, attacks into Kenya, which, of course, is bordering, which there's more agreement on that, and that is tied to some of these strikes against leaders in 2023, is that they were, the leaders being targeted are often involved in attacks outside of Somalia, specifically in Kenya. But there was also concern about, at least among some, about a potential threat to the United States or just further from Somalia. And that relates to, there's a charge against an individual who was affiliated, according to the charging documents, with Al-Shabaab, getting instructions, who was receiving flight training, I believe, in the Philippines. And the allegation is it was preparation for a sort of similar tactical plot to the 9/11 attacks targeting aviation. And you'll see that cited sometimes.
I want to ask you again a little further in a little bit about that threat assessment, but I want to move to the issue of secrecy now. It seems like sometimes the U.S. is claiming credit for the strikes, sometimes not. It's difficult for me to find a serious reason, normative, strategic, or otherwise, that the U.S. should be able to be, you know, legitimately bombing another country in secret, you know. But I'm reminded of the work of Michael Poznanski. I don't know if you are familiar, but he was on the show a while back, who basically argues that governments will do things out in the open when they can offer some plausible legal justification or rationale. But when there's no plausible legal legitimacy to it, they just keep it quiet. And that's basically what determines whether something is covert or overt. Do you have any speculation about why the U.S. would take credit for one strike in Somalia and not another?
So in Somalia, I don't know that we have clear evidence of a recent covert strike that we know or have really credible evidence was the United States. So all of these strikes, really the bulk of strikes, have been acknowledged by AFRICOM and put out by press release. Sometimes you have to bug AFRICOM. They, at least previously, had this tendency where they would not do a press release if the strike didn't kill or injure anyone, which to me is not really reasonable or justifiable, and certainly not transparent. But I think it seems that's gotten better, and if you press them, they'll acknowledge those strikes. And so we do have sort of a full list of what AFRICOM acknowledges is conducting.
Okay. But on that point, there's been some suspicion of increased U.S. strikes in Yemen, but you mentioned that the U.S. has not officially confirmed a strike there since 2020, even anonymously to journalists. But you add that, quote, the U.S. silence does not prove the absence of a larger campaign, as the United States has a history of maintaining secrecy or even simply lying about conducting strikes in Yemen. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, so I think Yemen is the case right now where there's really a stronger case that there's a U.S. secret campaign, or at least some secret U.S. strikes. And that relates to a pair of strikes that were reported in early 2023. First at the end of January and then in late February, where it appears likely that the United States was involved. The reasons for that suspicion are that the strikes, or at least one of them, killed a senior Al-Qaeda figure. So we have a reason why the U.S. would be doing this at a time when the U.S. has said it no longer considers Yemen to be an active area of hostilities. There was also various open source analysts believed that the strike, at least one of the strikes, used Hellfire, I'm going to mess it up, the Ninja missile, which is a specialized technology and a little bit of a likely signature of a U.S. strike. And then you had reporting from Yemen with local officials, I believe, anonymously attributing it to the United States. And that combination provides a strong suspicion that you have these two strikes we can understand why these would be United States strikes. And you have reporting saying, blaming the U.S. Now, on top of that, the United States has a history of covert strikes in Yemen, notably initially in 2002. That first strike was meant to be covert, although the U.S. quickly claimed it because it wanted to tout it as a success in the war on terror. And then when strikes occurred in 2009 and sort of the return and first escalation of the war under Obama, those were originally blamed upon Yemeni forces and not the U.S., with the U.S. denying a role. And just as importantly, more recently, we know that CENTCOM's numbers are not necessarily the full extent of recent U.S. strikes. The reason we know that is in 2020, CENTCOM says it did not conduct any strikes in Yemen. In fact, it told Air Wars and that its last strike was in 2019. Yet, we have reporting from the New York Times citing a U.S. Senior official that the CIA conducted a strike in 2020 that killed, or at least targeted, I think the official said it killed, but there may be some questions still. The Al-Qaeda figure who enabled the, and was involved in the attack in Pensacola, Florida. And that official said, told the New York Times that it was a CIA drone strike. But notably, well, the U.S. government officially and publicly did not say it was a U.S. drone strike. It did also say that in a press conference by then Attorney General Barr and FBI Director Wray that a counterterrorism operation had been conducted that targeted that figure. So we do have the strong reason to believe there's a CIA effort in Yemen, but the extent of it is not clear. And it is possible that those strikes, the two 2023 strikes, could have been the Emiratis or a U.S. partner, and the U.S. wasn't fully involved or pushing, or was involved but didn't push the button, may have provided the intelligence. But there's certainly reason to suspect, and we know in prior cases, or at least there's strong reason to believe, based on sourcing from within the U.S. government that's been reported by various media, that there were CIA strikes in Yemen in the sort of 2020 period.
So, again, to get back at this threat assessment issue, you cite a number of scholars on Yemen, Elizabeth Kendall, Sarah Phillips, saying essentially that U.S. counterterrorism policy in Yemen is targeting a group, AQAP, that policymakers themselves don't seem to have an understanding of. And that's probably true with al-Shabaab too, you know, framing that as a threat to the U.S. national security. They have largely local concerns, even though that it does spread out a little bit, but not to U.S. borders. Talk a bit about the threat inflation that perpetuates this low-intensity counterterrorism war and whether these groups actually pose a serious threat to U.S. national security.
Yeah, I think those particular points relate more to various understandings of how decentralized, specifically in those analyses, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula is or maybe, and not necessarily the threat. But in terms of what the threat is, there's a lot of reason to believe that it's relatively low for the U.S. homeland today. There's very few arrests of people in the United States involved in jihadist terrorism. Many of those arrests are people who are Americans, have lived here for a while, and are inspired or reacting to propaganda or just sort of the general air of conflict and connecting it to Al-Qaeda's mission, not being directed. That said, there is reason to remain concerned about the potential for attacks. Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula did at least coordinate an attack within the United States in 2019 that was deadly. And that was really the first deadly such attack, according to our tracking, since 9/11. Now, that attack, the shooting in Pensacola, looks quite different. Instead of 19 hijackers who all receive training and have this really deep preparation as basically a commando unit in Afghanistan by Al-Qaeda, you had one individual who communicated with an Al-Qaeda figure in Yemen before conducting the attack and discussed sort of the attack, shared a manifesto. So that looks different, but it also does point to, at the very least, continued intent of an actual Al-Qaeda structure to conduct external attacks and some level of cooperation and direction, which is significant. Similarly, in 2009, the U.S. narrowly avoided a major attack because the bomb fizzled with the 2009 Christmas Day bomb attack directed out of Yemen, where they actually there provided the bomb.
Cases like that seem to almost prove the point of a low threat. You know, this massive masterminded operation coming out of this group in Yemen, you know, strapped some explosive device to somebody's underwear and it didn't work. You know, most of these things are just failed and half-assed attempts. But when we think about the threat assessment, the next obvious question when digging into drone policy is, are they effective? Is this use of this particular tactic and the way we're going about it actually measurably keeping Americans safe from this low probability threat that you described, or making some progress in defeating these roving militant groups around the world? And you argue that the assessment of efficacy is basically impossible so long as we continue to have shifting, vague, often unlimited and unachievable objectives. We can't really perform that kind of assessment. Why not?
Right. So my analysis is that the U.S. has historically and still today, there's still a sort of ongoing legacy with impact of this objective of destroying Al-Qaeda and really, to some extent, even just more generally defeating terrorism. Although that's really fallen by the wayside as something people explicitly reference. And that objective, in my view, is unachievable because there's various reasons why Al-Qaeda is resilient, but also it's decentralized. It's able to reconstitute itself at these sort of perhaps very minimal levels, but still it doesn't take that much to have some kind of organizational connection between people, especially if they're sort of broader ongoing movements that are embedded in sort of the regional conditions that don't appear to be fundamentally changing in a way that would eliminate any appeal of the movement. Although there's certainly debate around some of those questions. The issue for effectiveness is, if that unachievable objective is still continuing, well, we increasingly know and people recognize that that can't be achieved. But then the question becomes, what about these other objectives that may not require that, such as destroying Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula's capability to conduct major attacks and threaten the U.S. homeland, or the similar threat out of Pakistan. And there's real reason to believe that the drone campaigns may have done that, both in Pakistan and in Yemen. The issue is that we're not able to really analyze whether that's effective, because the persistence of this unlimited objective is sort of preventing the analysis of questions like, when do you transition away from conducting strikes? Is the transition from conducting strikes something that is sustainable? Which really goes to this issue of, if you're pursuing a limited objective, one of the real challenges of a limited objective that does not fully destroy the enemy, so that's not an unlimited objective, relates to, are you able to sustain your gains while the enemy is still existing in some form? And that's where I would argue we tend to see this breakdown, where it doesn't get enough thought, it's not publicly discussed, linking back to the beginning of some of these campaigns in Pakistan and Yemen was covert. So we don't get a good sense of what was the actual, was there an envisioning of an actual limited objective at any point? And how are we looking today compared to that? You also, the unlimited objective and this idea of eventually defeating the group in totality worrisomely begins to fill in to cover for the issues with failures of achieving limited objectives. You see sort of, well, we've decreased capabilities, but maybe it's not sustainable. The answer to that doesn't become a debate over what is necessarily sustainable, but becomes often calls for further action because we've made achievements, but we need to defeat the group. And that's in large part my worry about the way that unlimited objectives and their endlessness, it would be different if one's assessment is you could just destroy the group. But if your analysis is you can't destroy the group, which is increasingly the shared analysis of people, even who are critical of arguments for any kind of withdrawal, then we need to be discussing the actual specifics of what are the end states or desired end states for a campaign. Otherwise, you're not able to say, was it effective or not? Because right. It's always postponed to the never, or the analyzed as never coming unlimited defeat of the Al-Qaeda group or network.
So you've dug very deeply into this concept of endless war. You identify two conditions that have to be met for something to be defined as an endless war. First, that a belligerent is pursuing objectives it lacks the ability to achieve, which you just talked about. And second, that belligerent is also not at risk of being defeated or denied access to the battlefield, which is a huge asymmetry of power here. And we talked about the threat inflation before. But before we move on a little bit, you write that, quote, numerous commentators and analysts have dismissed the concept of endless war as a meaningless slogan. Can you explain their perspective? Why do they think this doesn't mean anything?
Yeah, I think the broadest argument or thing pushing that argument is the view that endless war is a political talking point that just expresses exhaustion with the costs of America's wars. But moving beyond that, I think there's perhaps two different but related arguments that people make. One is that the U.S. commitment of the U.S. commitment and the kind of actions the U.S. takes should not be understood as war, that it's something below what would really be understood as war, and therefore it's not an endless war. There may be occasional counterterrorism operations, there may be cooperation, or even an ongoing military presence, sort of forward presence, but it's not, it's either not at the level of war, or I think sometimes this blurs into maybe you could analyze it as war, but what people, what they argue is that by saying endless war, people are comparing it to the heights of the Iraq or Afghanistan wars, and that is just not the same. And I think that's true. My argument is that that's not what endless war means. And part of the value of analyzing endlessness is what it can tell us about when one claims authority, and an authority grounded in sort of an understanding of what's being done as largely a broader war, not just an occasional, we did a raid to try to arrest someone and maybe there was resistance and they got killed, but stated objectives of we're doing military operations to defeat a group or to degrade a group or to deny territory. That's still, there's value to understanding the endlessness in that context, even when it's not the scale of like 2003, 2004, 2006 Iraq. I think the second argument people make and mobilize is that the endlessness, to the extent that it exists, is not driven by the United States' choices. It's driven by Al-Qaeda and the jihadist movement's commitment to ongoing warfare. And that, therefore, an accusation of endless war focused on the United States becomes sort of a talking point that doesn't actually connect to the issue area, that the U.S. may seek to end its war, but the jihadists or others won't, and that doesn't, and that there's the way that endless war functions in public discourse sort of avoids that. And I, there's some fairness to that. My argument is that there's still, first, I think there is more U.S. choice involved than people sometimes give credit, particularly in some of these cases where jihadist groups and Al-Qaeda affiliates in the network are relatively weak, particularly with regard to their ability to target the U.S. homeland. I think the second issue is that even if that is the case, that this is being driven by the enemy's own endlessness, or at least an interaction between the two, it's still valuable to understand that quality as an endlessness. So those are the two main, how I would see the two main responses to that complaint, that there are actual U.S. choices, and in addition, even if the U.S. is not able to make a decisive choice to change it, we should still understand the quality of the conflict we're in. It doesn't become, it doesn't stop being endless just because we haven't figured out a way out. That's actually part of what is so central to endlessness, that it's difficult to find a way out.
So let's talk maybe about some of the ways out. In a paper on the theater in Yemen, you propose a number of reform ideas that I think are probably applicable to counterterror drone strikes in general. But these include repealing the 2001 AUMF, stricter oversight of counterterrorism operations, presumably from Congress, thorough public reviews of operations and objectives, and so on. So I want to give you a chance to talk about how you might think about reforming these areas of policy.
Yeah, I think all of those are key areas. One thing that I want to emphasize, particularly given the recent challenges of tracking strikes in Somalia and Yemen, is the real need for the United States to be able to credibly deny that it conducted a strike when it did not conduct a strike. And potentially that may mean a need to be able to attribute major strikes by others to who's conducting those strikes. And one of the problems we've been gifted by the way the United States waged its war on terror earlier is that we can't trust just a statement from the combatant command that we did not conduct the strike, because there are other parts of the government, like the CIA, that conduct covert strikes that wouldn't end up in that data. Now, one might address that by just removing any authority for anyone other than the military to conduct strikes. One might address that by having some broader reporting rules around covert strikes. There used to be a sort of overarching need to report more broadly on casualties. There may be other transparency measures, and there may be value to just having a centralized denial capability that even if there's ones that are covert and you want to maintain covert, to be covert, that there's a ability to, in cases where it's really important strategically or because it's a major incident and it was not us, to have someone who can say, that was not us, here's the evidence, it was someone else. I would probably personally tend to, we should not be conducting secret wars and secret strikes, that they should all eventually end up in a public statement. Now, there may be reasons why that may not be the best way, but those should be tied to particular analyses of the state of conflicts and a real understanding of the risk of how it undermines broader U.S. aims when the United States is not able to credibly deny and really just end the speculation on a strike by saying that was not us. So that's something I want to raise up. The authorization for the use of military force is a longstanding and obvious site because it's the place where much but not all of the authorities derive from. And it's a place where there can be centralization on really overarching placement of restrictions and reporting requirements on what the United States does. There's many different proposals of what that would look like. I'm not most up to date on exactly where all of these stand in support in Congress of the various measures, and I think each of them deserves debate on its own, as well as the question of whether the U.S. should just repeal the AUMF and not just reform it. But the main areas, I think, revolve around geographic restrictions on where force is authorized, tied to assessments of what is the actual threat and nature of the groups posing that threat, and is the U.S. rightfully committed to waging war in those. Also, temporal restrictions, if the U.S. is going to keep the authorization, imposing some sort of sunsetting requirement or review. There's also value if one chooses to maintain some form of authorization for greater reporting out of what is happening, using this as a form of reporting requirement. And yeah, there's a lot of different ones, but I think those are some of the major areas for consideration. And the reason why the AUMF is so important, in my view, and I know there's some who criticize the reform efforts as not just not enough, but also a distraction into procedural aspects. My tendency is to view it as a real spot where there can be centralized changes to across the board restriction of what Congress thinks is authorized and then can build out from it. And I do not see Congress's failure to actually mobilize a decision on that as a disproof of the importance of it. To me, it's actually the failure and the failure to have done this around authorization questions around the ISIS war and to have punted on that for sort of a, well, we'll figure it out, or it's not really the core question. The core question is just the war itself. To me, we're paying the costs now of not having done that. And well, the war didn't just stop because people didn't push on the authorization or focused on other things. There's going to be wars where, and conflicts where the U.S. likely is rightfully going to want to have some involvement for real security interests. And in those cases, the it's just procedure argument does not provide much ground for value. And it really begins to break down when those conflicts begin to move from a situation where there may have been a real meaningful threat the United States had a legitimate basis to respond to when that threat is degraded and there's sort of a lingering presence. And now, because there wasn't a real effort on the procedural concepts of authorization, there's not this kind of forcing structure to, well, is this conflict over or not? And you get these sort of lingering endlessness aspects. So my view is the AUMF is an absolutely essential place to focus, and it's a deep mistake of people to treat it as just procedure.
David Sturman, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thank you.